I'm Brian McCreath from WCRB with Vadim Gluzman, who's here with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. I think maybe for the first time at Symphony Hall. Am I correct about this, Vadim?
That's right. We've played a couple of years ago at Tanglewood, and this is first time here.
Well, welcome to Boston. It's great to have a little bit of your time today. I thank you for that. You have a background that has taken you in many places, born in Ukraine and spent a lot of time in Latvia, ending up in Israel, I guess, eventually. And I wonder if your work as a violinist, how that was affected by that much moving from one place to another, and maybe even whether you encountered different ways of looking at playing the violin in those different places.
Well, most certainly. Every experience that we come across in our life affects us in the most profound way, I think. And having had the privilege, I guess I could say, of living in so many places, I've absorbed quite a bit. And when it comes down to music making, of course, I started my education back in what used to be Soviet Union, and then coming to Israel when I was just about 16 years old, and suddenly I realized that there is such thing as oxygen. I didn't know it existed. And to feel the freedom suddenly and to have a freedom of choice is really a remarkable achievement, which we were not exposed to back in Soviet Union. And then, of course, every country I visited, every musician I come across, every teacher that taught me, and et cetera, it all leaves its mark. So at the end of the day, it's a huge mishmash of cultures, traditions, ideas, you name it.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that, though. When you say that you've discovered oxygen, I think were your words, as a musician, does that indicate that the way that you were being trained in the Soviet Union was very controlled and very regimented, and that perhaps when you got to Israel, there was more freedom in the way that you wanted to approach music? Is that accurate?
That's very, very fair, yes. The education in Soviet Union was at the same time incredibly strict and authoritarian in its essence, at the same, which I today consider to be very, very negative. Yet at the same time, we were trained from day one on the absolutely professional level. There was no, "Oh, honey, have you had fun today?" No one cared. We were told that we are musicians. In the first grade, in this special school for gifted children, we were 7 out of over 200 applicants, and we were 6 in the second grade. One didn't make it. But then we were trained to do what we're told, and that presented a lot of problems for me, just because I'm really an obedient person, and when I'm told what to do, the very least I would like to know why. And I kept asking the questions, which did not go across very well with my teachers, with most of them. But still, I didn't know any better. I didn't know any different way of studying, teaching, making music. And then when I arrived in Israel, I discovered so many things. I certainly would not be where I am and do what I do if not for that move.
And you also did some study in New York, I think, after that, including with Dorothy DeLay, who trained, it seems like, almost everybody. But that must have furthered that sense of discovery and openness when you came to a place like New York, even though it was still this highly professionalized training.
Of course. Well, Ms. DeLay definitely was the smartest person I've ever met in my life. Her wisdom was really stunning. I had luck to be with her for 4 last years of my studies, and it was already the beginning of my touring life, and I really could not have had a better advisor, a better kind of guardian angel to warn me about the underwater stones that I did not see at the time. And she did save me from quite a few embarrassments. But she was truly a grand woman, a wonderful musician with very sophisticated taste, which she never imposed on us. Her way of teaching was, and honey, what do you think about it? She was always asking us to think, asking us to offer our ideas and develop our own sense. And then she, of course, would comment and give us her opinion. And when things were not good, physically speaking, technically, we would get hell, of course. There was no shortage of that. But there was an enormous respect for the student in front of her. And that is essentially is the difference between the so to speak, Soviet manner of teaching and Western, let's say.
It's a terrific image. I think I'll have to put this one back and remember it for future use. The underwater stones, that's a great image. And yet here you are, you're with the BSO playing, you know, the very core of the violin repertoire. So this is clearly, I can't imagine this isn't a piece that you haven't known for decades, going back to when you were a very young violinist. So to help me out with that transition from the way that you had grown up into these more open ways and discovery ways of learning, how did that affect your look at the Brahms concerto, which is something you kind of grew up with in a certain way, and then were asked to say, what's your idea about the Brahms concerto?
That was probably the most difficult transition. I did learn Brahms already when I was in the West, and so my luggage of Brahms was rather traditional recordings that we were exposed to, and they're still my favorites, David Oistrakh and Henrik Schering and Yehudi Menuhin and Isaac Stern. But finding your own voice in a piece that bears such an enormous weight of decades of great interpretations. That is the biggest challenge, of course, to not give in to what we call tradition, for better or worse, but to actually try to find yourself in this score. And it is the most challenging, yet with time, as I grow older, I find this to be the most exhilarating process. To try to find what I want to say and why do I play this music, and for every piece that comes in my repertoire, the answer is very different, of course.
And for the Brahms, it's such a symphonic concerto that it must have a continual input from other orchestras and other conductors that you're working with, because you have this collaboration going on with this concerto that's not the same when you're talking about earlier classical concertos or anything. So the second movement is maybe the best example, right? The oboe solo. And I wonder, as a soloist, how much do you hear that oboe solo in any given orchestra and respond to it with something that maybe you hadn't done with the previous time that you played it?
Each and every time. There is no other way, at least for me. Not only for Brahms concerto, we react to what we hear, and the interpretation morphs from one encounter with an orchestra to encounter with another orchestra. And needless to say, today I play Brahms with Boston Symphony. I react to what I hear comes onto me from the stage, and I get inspiration from it. Next week, it will be a different story with a different orchestra. It will be a different concerto. Otherwise, why don't we just play a recording? This is, I think, the biggest joy of live performance. It is never the same twice. Never, ever.
Is there any particular reason that you chose the Brahms for this week? I mean, obviously in conversation with the BSO and with Tugan, but was there something about it that you wanted to bring to Boston for this particular week of concerts?
Well, it was, I guess, a natural progression from Beethoven concerto that I played last time with the BSO. And choosing repertoire is always such a complex undertaking between wishes of the orchestra, considerations, what has been played, what hasn't been played recently or for a long time, my preferences, my season, what pieces are being in the active repertoire, what pieces are not so much, and then of course the conductor, and not necessarily in this order, of course. So it crystallized into Brahms, and I don't think I'll be ever upset about being asked to play Brahms concerto.
That's a good way to put it. You're right. And as it turns out, you just released a recording of it not very long ago. Also includes the Brahms first violin sonata, which is just one of my favorite pieces. And tell me about playing Brahms in a chamber music setting like that versus playing it in an orchestral setting. Is it really the same Brahms, or maybe the better way to put it is, what side of Brahms do we hear in orchestral, in the orchestral concerto versus the what Brahms do we hear in the sonata, the chamber music setting?
I think there is one side of Brahms that is ever present, and that is the chamber music side. If we look through his oeuvre, we will never find a piece where one voice completely dominates all others. It simply does not exist. Look at his concerti. Look at the double concerto, at both piano concertos, violin concerto. It is never an accompaniment, proper accompaniment situation. It is always a collaboration. Sarasate called this concerto against the violin. This is a war with orchestra, and violin wins, which I would doubt. And he also said that why would he play this piece where the only good melody is given to the oboe? It shows you that Brahms, while of course violin is featured, clearly it is the solo voice, but it take away the orchestra. This music becomes unrecognizable, meaningless. Of course, it is still a beautiful line, but you lose more than half of it. Take Paganini concerto. You can easily play it without the accompaniment. You will have just as much fun. So that collaborative angle of writing is ever present in Brahms, and I think this is to me what is the most dear, that it is never a monologue. And I somehow enjoy dialogues much more.
Understandable. Vadim Glusman, thanks so much for your time, and welcome to Boston.
Thank you. Pleasure.